Hi everyone, I'm John Offord. I'm a broadcaster based in the UK and welcome to Different Minds, a podcast series that looks at neurodiversity, the different ways our brains can work and interpret information. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Aspire Autism Consultancy, the leading providers of autism and ADHD training, educating and enabling families, therapists and healthcare professionals to gain knowledge and understanding of neurodiversity. The courses are written by two specialist psychotherapists and include the voices and lived experiences of neurodivergent individuals. For further details, go to www.aspireautismconsultancy.co.uk. I'm delighted to be joined by Joy Johnson today, a behaviour analyst and autism advocate all the way from the US of A. Joy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
No worries. So Joy, tell us about how has this year been for you? It's been a very unusual year for most of us, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been really crazy for me because although, you know, the pandemic and everything has been really tragic, in terms of, I guess, my career, you know, and things that I've been doing within the community, things have been very, it's been very positive. You know, I never thought that I could be like an advocate in terms of like speaking prior to COVID. Yeah. But because everything was done via Zoom,
yeah,
it kind of helped me work out, you know, like anxiety and stuff that I would have had to speak publicly.
Absolutely.
So now I do a lot of public speaking because I can do it kind of like comfortably, you know, like from yeah, my home,
yeah,
and not absolutely have to worry about the things that would normally happen in the setting of like, you know, like public speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no kind of commuting either. You don't have to worry about where to park the car or anything like that. So it's a lot easier, isn't it, on Zoom?
Right.
So just tell us a bit more about the advocacy work that you do. And I know that you also, you've got a master's in education, a master's in psychology, and I believe you're currently finishing a PhD. Is that right?
Yes.
Wow. So you're pretty busy then.
Yeah. So I really came into the field of psychology and ABA to change it. Because as I'm sure you may know, it's very controversial because it's a lot of trauma and harm that's been done to our population, because we haven't been considered the consumers that we are and the key stakeholders. So my goal in coming into the field was to do research that kind of validates our voices as autistic people.
Yeah.
Because most treatments surround like neurotypical standards.
Yep.
But, you know, it doesn't make sense to do that when you're treating autistic people. So I thought I would join the field to kind of bring that perspective and to try to, you know, provide a solution to the harm that's currently going on and change it.
So a lot of your work is to kind of work with individuals, organizations, and families to essentially improve the lives of autistic people.
You know, like I said, I've been doing a lot of public speaking lately. So I've been presenting at like professional symposiums, conferences that are like other ABA professionals, and kind of educating them on race and the intersectionality of autism and neurodiversity. So I do a lot of ethics courses, you know, like teaching a lot of professionals about ethics. And then I also treat. So, you know, every day I have clients, adults and children, that I help either them directly or their parents with like behavior issues like self-injury, aggression, harm.
So Joy, when you mention race and intersectionality, can you just break that down to some of our listeners that perhaps aren't familiar with the term intersectionality? What does that actually mean?
Okay, well, there's, you know, being Black, I belong to a marginalized community.
Yeah.
Being autistic, I belong to a marginalized community. And it's kind of like intersectionality is where they both meet, you know?
Yeah.
And you have to consider both of them in serving me, you know, or serving an individual that looks like me in therapy and interventions. Like, so if you don't consider my neurodiversity or my Blackness, then you're not culturally competent nor responsive in my treatment. In America, people need to consider that the fact of the matter is, you know, Black people are treated differently than white people. So that means behaviorally, you might have to take a little bit, a couple of extra steps in teaching me. All autistic people need to advocate for themselves, you know? But when you're Black and autistic, there's a certain way that you need to know how to engage with like law enforcement, and approach them in a very, a more cautious and careful way. Because they're more prone to view us as a threat. So I'll give you an example. I could be having a meltdown in public. You know, I'm a Black female. And I would automatically be accosted or apprehended thinking that I was on drugs or, you know, a threat. But if I had a peer that was white and autistic, they would be approached and asked if they needed assistance. And it automatically felt like, oh, something must be wrong. We need to help her. But because the way implicit bias works, people view me and they don't think something could be wrong. They think, oh my gosh, she's threatening. Yeah. You know, she's on drugs. She's mentally ill. We have to apprehend her and subdue her immediately rather than saying, you know, are you having a hard time? You know, I'm automatically criminalized.
And what about in the workplace then in the US in terms of kind of racism?
Oh, wow. In the workplace, you know, we have a lot of things in the US called code switching. So I'm not sure if it's really like that in the UK, but in America, there are certain dialects that like you can sound as if you're white or Black by societal standards, you know? So if you are not someone who knows how to accommodate those, like the code switching in terms of changing your dialect, you may be perceived as urban or a threat because of, you know, because of that dialect. So you have to kind of, you don't have to, because I don't code switch, but like people are programmed to think that you need to change the way you act to be more white. You know, in a place of business. So if you're autistic, sometimes your behaviors can kind of like amplify the implicit biases that are already existent. Like I'm naturally loud and it's probably due to me being autistic, but people see that I'm Black and they perceive me as an aggressive Black woman, you know? And I'm not aggressive. I'm autistic, you know? So, you know, it's just, it's sad, but there, you know, color does play a big factor in terms of what people look at you and how they size you up.
And what about the fact that you're female? Does that make a difference? Are we, you know, often people, the stereotypical view is that autism is more prevalent in males rather than females. I mean, what would you
say? So I think that's like, you know, I train police officers here, and one of the things I was told is if I was approached, you know, that wouldn't be one of the first things that came to mind. They would think I was on drugs. But if I was a white male, they may think, oh, maybe, you know, he's autistic because, you know, he's engaging in this type of behavior. But for me, being, you know, a female, that's one of those things that is like the last things on the list. Plus, you know, women, we know how to mask a little bit, you know, like it's just something that we learn how to do. So people don't view us as looking as autistic, whatever that means, you know, as males. And I don't really think autism has a, you know, like a look. Like, I don't agree when people say, oh, you look, you know, autistic AF. Like, I don't really get what that means, you know?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you there. So would it be fair to say that, I don't know, autistic females are more likely to experience high rates of depression and anxiety? What would you say to that, Joy?
Yes, but okay, I'm gonna play devil's advocate for a minute. I think that autistic females are, although we may not be viewed as autistic initially, I think that we are accepted in society better, because when girls are quirky or quote unquote weird, you know, and don't fit into the societal norm, we're more accepted because it's like cute, you know, because we're sexualized into like, oh, she's cute because she's weird or quirky. But if a guy is like that, it's a lot harder for him, you know? So I kind of feel like in that aspect, like girls, we never have problems like finding dates and stuff, you know, because men, oh, she's cute, she's weird. But it's because of this what people associate with masculinity automatically. Yeah. Autistic males have it a little bit harder when it comes to like a social life if they're dealing with society at large and what women view that men are supposed to look like. You know what I mean?
Yeah, really.
So in that aspect, I feel like, you know, men have a little bit harder, but in the aspect of women, meaning as young girls, like as a young girl, I was probably a lot more promiscuous than I would have been if I was neurotypical, because it was a way for me to mask. It was one way, kind of like sexualizing myself was one way as a girl that I learned that I could fit in and be accepted. In a way that I knew how to engage with my peers socially, and I felt quote unquote normal, you know?
Yeah.
So I always tell parents to kind of be careful, because girls is something that we know we can kind of like fall back on. If we're weird and not accepted, all we have to do is kind of like play into the, you know, I'm just a wild sexual being. We can engage.
So you're basically, you're saying girls may hide their symptoms or put more time and energy into learning social norms. And I guess autistic girls are more likely to be able to form friendships than autistic boys. Would that be true?
Right. But I think there's societal like pressures to do that. You know what I'm saying? Like we kind of, we realize that really young, like if you can't fit in any other way, then a way to do it is to kind of like sexualize yourself. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I always tell parents to be careful with girls with that, because that was my default. I felt like I couldn't fit in any other way.
Yeah.
But when I started, you know, becoming sexually active, it was like, oh, she's popular. And I was weird and quirky. So I just kind of came off as this rebellious,
yeah,
you know, like highly sexual being. And it was a way that I finally felt accepted.
Yeah.
But was it fulfilling? Was it healthy? No, you know, but it was just a way that I felt like I could fit in, you know?
Yeah. Makes sense. So Joy, I wonder if you could just tell us about your own personal journey and talk us through when you were diagnosed with autism.
I was diagnosed with childhood schizophrenia first.
Right.
Because I'm 43. So back in the day, they weren't, you know, it wasn't as prevalent, you know?
Yeah.
So they saw a child that was script, and I scripted, which means I talked to myself, but I didn't have functional speech.
Right.
So I was non-vocal in the sense where I wouldn't talk to you, but I would repeat things that I saw on television or something like that, you know?
Yes.
So I was diagnosed officially with autism at 6.
Right.
I was non-vocal until I was 12.
Wow.
So I started speaking at 12. A lot of things changed for me. However, in America, they have something called certificate track. So because I had been non-vocal for so long, I wasn't allowed to graduate from high school. They gave me something called a certificate, which is not a high school equivalent.
Right.
So essentially you go to school for nothing.
Yeah.
So I didn't get a GED, which is like a high school replacement here. I didn't get that until I was 26.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, at what age did you kind of understand what it meant to have an autism diagnosis?
Okay, so I always knew that I was autistic, but I didn't understand what it really meant probably until I was in my
20s.
Right, yeah. What I really love about nowadays is, you know, kids have Google, so they can Google and look up stuff. Yeah. You know, back when I was young, it's going to make me sound really old, but I guess it's true. There was no internet, so I couldn't like Google stuff about myself, you know?
Yeah.
So I only knew what I was told, and I knew I was autistic, and that was about it. I could have probably looked at encyclopedias and stuff, you know, in my home, but I wasn't that inquisitive, you know, like at that point.
Yeah.
So in my 20s, although, you know, the internet was still relatively new, I could kind of seek out things, you know, and find out more about myself and became more curious. And that's when I kind of developed more self-awareness as, okay, nothing is wrong with me per se.
Yep.
I just have these differences, and it makes sense because, you know, I have this diagnosis of autism. So, okay, this is what this means for me, you know?
So was that beneficial for you then? Because you kind of knew, was it a kind of a relief? Because you know that the way that you think might be a little bit different to what we call a neurotypical person. And did it kind of make sense when you had that realization?
Yes. And I feel like, because I help a lot of late diagnosed people get late diagnosed. And I think once you find out, that really helps facilitate self-awareness, because you can learn more about the tribe that you belong to, you know, because it's like essentially like a tribe, you know. Like you're a little bit different than everybody else in your family, and you know, you belong to this tribe, and you need to kind of seek out and find out, you know, and then you find these other people that are like you, and you're like, I'm not alone. You know, I do this, and then you can kind of find your peers and having peer support to talk to you like, that happens to me too, or that did, and this is how you go through it, you know, so it really helps you to develop self-awareness and a place of a sense of belonging and a sense of like, you know, nothing is wrong with me. I'm just different, you know?
Absolutely. So would you say it's more and more common now for adults kind of later in life to receive an autism diagnosis?
It is. What also is kind of common is, you know, on social media, a lot of people self-diagnose themselves.
Yep.
What I'm still kind of like on the fence about. I know, like within my community, everybody says, you know, like you want to be accepting, which I get. And I do have empathy for those people that feel like they belong within the community, but they suspect they're autistic, but not sure. Do I believe that people that are self-diagnosed, there are a lot of people that are self-diagnosed that are autistic? Yes. Do I believe there are a lot of people that are self-diagnosed that aren't? Yes.
Yeah.
You know? So
I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
It's really difficult for you to diagnose yourself and be objective. You know,
of course.
There could be other comorbid disorders that you may be thinking that kind of mimic autism that may not be autism, you know?
Yeah.
So that makes it kind of difficult. And I think that it can be kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
And I do realize that diagnosis is a privilege, you know?
Sure.
But I think it's really important to seek out whatever benefits your country may have to help get like free medical assistance to get on the right path. Cause if you misdiagnose yourself, that also could be very dangerous, you know?
And I've heard sometimes in some countries that the way that people with autism are diagnosed, it's kind of more kind of biased to kind of the male kind of way of thinking.
It has a lot to do with race, you know, socioeconomic status. I help a lot of people that are self-diagnosed by giving them free assessments, which will open the window, because if the assessment reveals that, hey, this person fits the criteria, then they can take that to their doctor, you know?
Yeah.
And it kind of gives you like a leg to stand on rather than saying, you know, I Googled this, you know? So in America, assessments can be really expensive, like $1,200, $1,300. And I started a program where I can help and I give people these assessments for free to try to help remove some of those barriers to diagnosis.
That's amazing. Wow, that's really incredible. So what are the benefits then once you think of getting an autism diagnosis?
Resources.
Yeah.
It's a lot of resources. You're not gonna, you know, get like ABA and stuff as an adult, but there's still other like, you know, OT, speech, all kind of things. I mean, and you could get ABA, but it'll be more of in a self-management, you know, kind of way.
Yeah.
But just the resources that you're entitled to, once you get the assessments, it'll help you identify accommodations that you may need to request at work. And then you'll have the support of the diagnosis to validate the accommodations. So it helps a lot to be able to just have, you know, that to stand on, like, I need these accommodations because I am an autistic person, you know?
Yeah. Some people might be thinking, what does it actually mean to be autistic?
That is a really difficult question because it's so vast and diverse. It can mean and be different things for different people. Like, a lot of people you see on social media are quote unquote neurotypical passing. That's not the demographic that I serve. And that's not what I once was either. Like now, you know, I'm 43, so I've mastered, I guess, neurotypical presentation, you know, but that doesn't always help happen for everybody.
Yeah.
I have a lot of sensory issues. So for me, it really, really means a lot of difficulty processing, perceiving how sensory impacts me, but for other people that might not be the case, you know. Not everybody who's autistic has issues with sensory, just like people think that all autistic people stem. You don't have to stem to be autistic, you know.
Yeah.
So there's no real like concrete, like, you are this, this, and this, and you're autistic. It's so diverse, and the spectrum is so vast, and so, you know, like, you can have so many different strengths and so many different challenges attributed to autism, but it just depends on the individual and their unique neurodiversity, you know?
And on that then, so on the concept of neurodiversity, would you say that's dividing the autism community, or would you say it's bringing the autism community closer together?
I think it's bringing it close together. There's still things that kind of divide it. I know, like, because in the UK, you guys still use the Asperger's diagnosis, right?
It was brought under the umbrella of ASD in 2013. That's right, isn't it?
Right. So here we don't use Asperger's anymore. And that was one of those things that kind of, like, people paired Asperger's with quote unquote high functioning autism. Yeah. You know, first of all, there's no such thing as high functioning autism. There never was.
Yeah.
Asperger's, yes, but high functioning and low functioning, those are kind of terms that people kind of like developed to describe people that is kind of really inaccurate and harmful. Yeah. So in that respect, I feel like that's where we're kind of divided sometimes, because people believe that people who are diagnosed with Asperger's, which, by the way, Asperger's was my diagnosis after 12, which has let you know I've gone through the whole spectrum and I know how harmful both can be.
Yeah.
Because at first I was considered like under 70, and then I was considered Asperger's. It's like they never really knew because they didn't have the correct assessment tools to gauge where I was.
Yeah.
And it was really harmful, because at first they're like, oh, you're low functioning, so you're not smart enough to do anything, you know?
Yeah.
So they didn't see my strengths, you know?
Yeah.
But then when you are diagnosed with Asperger's, they don't see your challenges, which can also be equally damaging.
Such a
but
good point. Yeah.
Neither one really accurately can gauge any, what can it really tell you about anything? Because I know people who are quote unquote old school, you know, they call themselves ASCIIs. They may have IQs, you know, that are off the chart, but they can't keep jobs.
Yeah.
But then you know somebody who's considered lower functioning, who has a cognitive disability, who's been holding the same job for 30 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so who's really higher or lower functioning if they can support themselves, you know?
You're right. Like, you so see, really, the language is not helpful, is it? That those low and high functioning labels, yeah.
It is very subjective.
Yeah.
Like, the functioning of somebody is very subjective, and especially when you don't have the proper assessment tools. If somebody is non-vocal, it's really difficult to assess them.
Yeah.
And most intellectual tests like are surrounded around verbal behavior. So if that's not your strength, you're not going to do well. And then a lot of assessors don't even know how to engage autistic people,
yeah,
you know, so that's another factor. So, you know, those are the only things that I see really dividing us. And yeah, I see some harmful things on social media, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I know that I don't hold the popular opinion.
Yeah.
When it comes to like TikTok videos and stuff.
Yeah.
But I see that as potentially harmful as well, because it gives you a picture. So people try to say, yeah, we do these TikTok videos to try to disseminate awareness, right?
Yeah.
But if you look on TikTok, it's kind of like all of these people are acting the same.
Yeah.
You know, they stem the same. And that's not, everybody doesn't stem so pretty and cute in front of the camera.
Yeah.
Everybody can't do that. Everybody can't set up a camera and wait to stem perfectly on cue. That's not how it looks.
Yeah.
So you're making it, you're giving the aesthetics of, you know, this is the way it looks, and, you know, it kind of looks trendy, when everybody who's autistic doesn't present like that. So people were really upset over that Sia lady.
Yes.
They were saying, you know, she didn't get an autistic person, and this person, you know, just acted autistic. But to me, it looked just like the monster that TikTok built.
Yep.
Everybody stemming the same way in the same manner. I don't know every autistic person in the world, but I've been in institutions since I was 3. I'm 43. I have autistic children myself. I treat autistic children every day. And I will tell you, everybody does not stem the same like that.
Yeah.
So is there a population of people that I think is attracted to TikTok because they are socially awkward, maybe haven't gotten attention their whole life, so they want to claim autism as a diagnosis and then get on TikTok and act it out?
Yeah.
That's what it looks like to me. And so I do kind of think that it's problematic, because it's making it look like we all look like that. We're all this white pretty, multicolored hair. There's a look, you know?
I know what you're saying. And on that very subject then, Joy, what would you say to some people perhaps say that often autism, some autism advocates, they're very able, they can communicate, they're very articulate. And, you know, some people say, well, they're not speaking on behalf of my child, and my autistic child, you know, has impairment, you know, issues and isn't able to communicate and articulate. And there must be something wrong with the spectrum, because how can you have all these same people on the spectrum? And the spectrum is often quite linear, and shouldn't it be more seem like more of a constellation rather than a linear spectrum?
Well, there's two sides to that. One is you don't know what that adult looked like, because how I present now is very different than I presented as a child, you know?
Yeah.
So if you are looking at an adult and questioning, oh, well, they look too quote unquote normal. First of all, you don't believe in your child, you know, to believe that they're just developmentally delayed and they will eventually come into their own, you know?
Yeah.
But second of all, it is possible that that person isn't like your child. But there is an autistic adult out there that you can find to kind of help, you know, maneuver through the things that you want to maneuver. But it is very difficult to find someone that's just like your child, because we all are so very different.
But
a lot of parents look at me and they're like, you know, like I could get that, you know, but you don't know that I didn't speak until I was 12. You know, like, you don't know that I was very aggressive and self-injurious, because I've grown up. I'm an adult. I've learned how to, you know, strategies to balance and, you know, help to monitor myself, you know, like, so if your child has those same tools, they can't do, will they look exactly like me when they grew up? No, everybody has their own way of figuring it out. But it's your job as a parent to support that. And listening to autistic voices is helpful, you know? Various ones, not just one particular one. You know, if you find an advocate that you like and you say, you know what, but maybe they don't fit the same type of mold of what I'm dealing with, there's always other adults out there that, you know, that may fit that mold.
Yeah. And what about language? I guess there's a massive paradigm shift when it comes to language use around autism. And, you know, I guess some people identify as neurodivergent. Some people call themselves neurominorities. Some people call themselves autistic. And I guess even with the term neurotypical, there's a term that I've heard recently, where a PNT, a predominant neurotype.
I didn't see, that's a new one for me. I didn't even know that one.
So I guess the predominant neurotype is a new term to describe a non-autistic person, because they feel that neurotypical is a dubious construct, because nobody can be considered truly neurotypical, as there can be no such standard for the human.
Things continue to evolve. Like, I haven't heard that one yet, but I'm sure when I hear the logic around it, you know?
Yeah.
So to me, the language is important, but things do continue to evolve. I also do realize, because I'm one of those people that have been through all of the languages. Like, you got to think about it. When I was a kid, I was still being called retarded because that was okay.
Gosh.
You know, so I've seen the transitions that occur, you know? So it's like, I'm prepared for it, but to be honest, for me, it's just like, I've been everything from PDD NOS to autistic to Asperger's to, you know, so I've been through the whole.
Essentially, they're labels, aren't they?
Yeah. So you kind of get used to it. And I realize no matter what, through all of these transitions, I'm still me, and I just have to figure out how I work as me. You know.
So Joy, so you have an autistic child, yeah?
Yeah, she's 26 though. She's an adult.
Okay. So how did you, as a parent, you know, when she was growing up, did you find any challenges there in terms of kind of society and how she fitted in? Was there any challenges there?
It was, but to be honest, and you probably gonna love this because you're in the UK, it was more challenges in America. So I left America and took her to Germany. Because America has all of these very solid constructs of what they think, you know, people should be. And I actually found Europe to be a little bit more accepting, well, a lot bit more accepting.
Right.
And didn't put her in a box. Yeah. You know, the education system is a lot more fluid, I guess you can say, than America, and a lot more accommodating. So in America, her problem was she got bullied a lot because she's not neurotypical passing.
Right.
So it was really difficult for her. But once we moved to Germany, I don't know, you know, well, I do know. The way, you know, the people are in Germany, people really didn't care. It was just, she's different. She was who she was, you know?
Yeah.
And they kind of like accepted her, you know, as she was. But here, you know, I guess because people teach their kids when you're in special ed and, you know, all these different differences, you separate people so much here, you know?
Yeah.
But there, it wasn't that separation. So she thrived there. You know, so it was fine.
You know, that's really good to hear. So in terms of like social models of disability and medical models of disability, would you say, do you think it's fair to say that the US kind of maybe see autism as something that needs to be treated, where maybe in like the UK or other parts of Europe, autism is seen as something that needs to be supported? Or is that just kind of language?
No, I have found recently that a lot of these agencies out here push recovery.
Right.
And there's no such thing as recovery, because recovery means you have to be returned to a state that you once were, right?
Yeah.
If I was never in that state, how can you return me to it?
Yeah.
All you're effectively doing is teaching me how to mask, which we all know is not helpful, because in the future, I'll everything falls apart, because I'm like, okay, I've been pretending to be this thing that I'm not, you know?
Yeah.
For my entire life. So there's no such thing as recovery, but a lot of people in America will pitch that. And I feel like it's very unethical also, because you pitch it to parents that are vulnerable and make them feel like their kids need to be fixed. You know, I don't think in other countries it's like that all the time. You know, like in Germany, it was more like, okay, they're different. We may do things different. And it really was like, no, I don't really care if they're different. Let's just find how they do it, and that's how they'll do it. You know?
Yeah.
And that's it. It's not like they need to be like us, you know?
Yeah.
And Germany is one of those really rigid countries that people expected that, but it was not like that at all.
Yeah.
It was like, let's just find what's best for her, and we'll do it that way, and that works. You know?
That's good. And I guess that mindset still exists, doesn't it? That autistic people have to fit into a neurotypical world. Where, why isn't it the other way around? Why don't autistic people have to make
right
to fit into
the very world? Notion of recovery is ableist, because that's pitching that we need to be like you.
Yeah.
Why do we need to be like you? Why can't we learn how to navigate the world how we are?
Yeah.
You know, yes, we have to learn how to navigate in the majority neurotypical world, you know?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean we have to act like you.
Yeah.
That just means we have to learn how to advocate. That means we have to, you know, certain coping strategies to deal with things that you guys might not understand, you know?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean we have to conform, because that's not going to be healthy for us. It's like you living a lie for your entire life. And no matter how good you are at doing it, I can tell you firsthand, the mask will crumble eventually. You can only do it for so long.
Yeah.
Before you just, it's like a mental breakdown. It's like somebody who's living, you know, like a falsehood, and then all of a sudden one day it just falls.
Yeah.
For women, commonly it's during menopause. Because that's, you just don't have the mental capacity to uphold any, you know, unauthentic ways anymore.
So Joy, you talked about understanding there and neurotypicals. I think you mentioned in a YouTube video that your husband is neurotypical.
He is.
Were there any challenges there? I know that doesn't really matter.
We've been married 20 years, right?
Yep.
So initially it was a lot of challenges.
Yeah.
Now I call him the autism whisperer. Because he's like great. You know, he's learned how to support me, but in doing that, I also had to learn that the world is not centered around me as well, which I think sometimes because of our parents, it's not intentional, you know?
Yeah.
But with like, we're coddled. There's a difference between requesting accommodations and thinking that the whole world needs to structure their actions around you, you know?
Yeah.
And I had to learn that difference being young and being in a marriage, because you can't expect, you know, like your NT partner to support everything and do everything, you know, like marriage is a compromise, you know?
Absolutely.
Like you have to learn what works for both of you.
Yeah.
And sometimes just because of, you know, like how our parents like may have coddled us and kind of teach us that learned helplessness sometimes, it's unintentional, but it's like a parental ableism that kind of like happens, you know, like, oh, they're autistic, we have to do this and we have to do that. That carries over into adulthood. And then when you enter relationships, sometimes that can be problematic.
So just a couple more questions as we come towards the end of the podcast. So mm-hmm. In terms of like, you know, what would you say is the future for neurodiversity? What do we need to do? What needs to change in society?
I think that there needs to be more like public dissemination of information of what neurodiversity is. Yep. Like, for example, in order to stop us from being killed by the police, there needs to be campaigns that are put out what crisis versus crime is. You shouldn't be calling the police on somebody who's having a meltdown. Yep. There needs to be better resources put in place for people who are having meltdowns. So if you do need to call some type of support system, it's not a police officer. You know, so 911, which I think it may be, it's 112 in Germany. I don't know what it is in UK.
999 in the UK, yeah.
999 needs to be a better triage system as to where they may, you know, kind of ask, like, is this person autistic? Does this person, you know, so you, yeah. I don't, and you guys may be doing that already. Yeah. But here, we're not, you know?
Yeah.
So those type of things in terms of like more public and community education on what neurodiversity is. On my side of the clinician, we need to stop trying to target and treat behaviors that are simply odd by neurotypical standards, you know?
Absolutely.
And that once people start to see stemming more because it's not being quote unquote treated, then it'll just become normal. Yep. You know, there's no reason for you to treat stemming unless it's harmful. Unless somebody's hitting their head against the wall, you know, stemming is not a harmful thing. So it needs to be left alone because it's the way that we regulate. But people need to understand that it's just a mode of regulation, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And final question, Joy. This is a question I ask all my guests on my podcast series. So if you had the opportunity, what advice would you give your younger self?
Don't believe what they tell you.
Brilliant.
I believe because I was autistic, I couldn't do a whole lot of things. And it held me back. I'm fortunate and I'm grateful that I was able to achieve the things that I achieved, but it took me a lot longer because I internalized and believed what people told me autism was. And to me, autism meant that I could not do a whole lot of things. And that's not what it means. It just means you may have to find a way to do it differently, but you can do it.
Joy, it's been a real pleasure speaking to you today. Thank you so much for your time and keep up the good work that you're doing over there in the US.
Thank you for having me.